I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Lectures and Literature at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you the voices of remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is author Mary Roach with musical group One Ring Zero, led by Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Mary Roach and One Ring Zero. Mary Roach has a brand of curiosity that is, to say the least, unorthodox. It leads her to explore questions such as, is vaginal orgasm a myth? Can a dead man get an erection? Why doesn't Viagra help women, or for that matter, pandas? The result of those investigations is revealed in her searing exposé, Bonk. She also has a what some would call perverse preoccupation with what happens to our bodies and souls, as evidenced in her books Stiff and Spook, After We Die. And now the indefatigable Mary Roach turns her attention to space as an outer in her latest book, Packing for Mars. What happens to you when you can't walk for a year? What happens if you vomit in your helmet during a spacewalk? Is it possible for the human body to survive a bailout at 4,000 miles per hour? And just because it seemed like a cool thing to do, we've brought the acclaimed band One Ring Zero, whose most recent album, Planets, is a collection of new compositions to represent the solar system and beyond, here to share the stage with Mary Roach. In fact, the lyrics to Zero Gravity, which you'll hear tonight, were written by Mary Roach in an earthly collaboration. One Ring Zero, led by Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, has released 7 albums, including the acclaimed literary collaboration As Smart As We Are, which features songs with lyrics contributed by such authors as Jonathan Latham, Margaret Atwood, Paul Auster, Dave Eggers, and Dennis Johnson. And just today, Juicy.com named Planets favorite album about the solar system of 2010. So, let's hear some songs from One Ring Zero, followed by Mary Roach. Welcome them.
So, as Barbara mentioned, we did a lot of work, have continued to do a lot of work with writers, and we released an album a few years ago where every song had lyrics by a different author, Dave Eggers and Jonathan Latham, as you mentioned. This is probably the least appropriate one to play at the JCC, but it's one of Mary Roach's favorites, so we're doing it for Mary. It has lyrics by Dennis Johnson.
Christ by the dumpster, peeling and a tossing your lottery tickets. Oh, Nazarene, drinking dust. Oh, Christ, rising and a falling. Oh, Jesus Christ, giving us the finger. And Christ, oh, Tombo. Bless, please, the people in art galleries, lonely as a distant train. Bless now the cancer of the bone, the last light making beautiful the poisons in the sky. And the condemned man in his tuxedo dream, his dream of limousines and innocence. Take off your clothes and come to him in dreams. stand on the fire escape, naked and blessed. Wet jazz like a review, little codeine, the laughter spilling from my broken necklaces. Galleries, lonely as a distant train. Bless now the cancer of the bone, the last light making beautiful the poisons in the sky. Christ by the dumpster, peeling and tossing your lottery tickets, O Nazarene. Drinking dust. Oh Christ, rising and a falling. Oh Jesus Christ, giving us the finger. In Christ the tumble.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp, thank you so much. And now, please welcome Mary Roach. So how did you first hear of these guys? And as you, as I said later, you're going to hear a song that One Ring Zero will play and that Mary wrote the lyrics for, which is a beautiful collaboration that sort of happened with Dan Wolfe and within our office and conversations with Michael Hurst. But how did you become familiar with their music?
Actually, Michael sent me a fan letter, mm-hmm. and then he had a link, and I went and listened to, actually it was Blessings, was the one that they just played, and I thought, I love these guys, and so I sent them in response a gushing fan letter, and sort of, you know, it was the Mutual Admiration Club. And then we went back and forth, and somehow this grew out of it. I think Dan Wolfe was involved.
Yes.
Yeah. And
it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and you're all here to share it. And CDs are available too, right?
The Planets. Had you written song lyrics before?
I have never written song lyrics, and I don't know that. It's a talent of mine that I obviously need to develop a little bit more, but it was so much fun.
Oh, I'm sure.
It really was, yeah.
Well, speaking of talents, you obviously, this is your fourth or fifth book, and you do have a talent for, it's popular science, but it's the way it hasn't quite been written before. And I read that you have a degree, not in science, but in psychology. So is that what you think, that psychological bent or way of thinking accounts for the subjects that you're drawn to and find interesting within the rubric of science?
Oh, good heavens, no. I was a psych major because I wanted to travel abroad my junior year, and the psych department was incredibly lax. They said, you can transfer those credits, go and have fun. I said, okay, I'm a psych major, and I never thought about it again.
I got it.
So, no, I think I came to science late. I never took science in college. I just started writing for Discover magazine, and science has kind of a bad rap. People think it's very complicated and dry, and it will be boring and tedious. But science is, you know, it's you, it's your body, it's your dog, it's a theremin, it's technology, it's the weather. I mean, how could it be boring? So really, it's just me, just this entree into all these different little universes and laboratories. I love labs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You're not all labs, but you know, like sex labs, where you just, you know.
So you've been in a lot
of
labs.
How awkward is that? You know,
a lot of labs. And we'll talk a little bit later about some of the simulations that you were able to experience as a result of researching this book. But let's go back to one of the first processes that we think about when we think about outer space. Those of us who aren't tutored in it, which is astronauts, and the astronaut selection process. Mm-hmm. I understand it's very different now than it used to be in the just post-chimp days.
Yes.
There's, so tell us what you learned about that.
Well, the Mercury era was This was boldly going, literally, where no one, well, one man, Yuri Gagarin, had gone before. So you wanted, test pilot mentality, aggressive, macho, kind of swinging balls guys, Air Force, a lot of them, military test pilots, bravado, swagger, ego. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, all these decades later, you're talking about longer missions, weeks, months, years in space, small space, 5-6 people in a little cramped space. That's the last thing. You don't want a huge ego. You want you want somebody who plays well with others. So you look at the astronaut recommended attributes, and you have things like flexibility, sense of humor, ability to form stable and quality interpersonal relationships. That's like they want Richard Gere in Knights and Rodanthe. it's just completely 180 degrees from what they were after in the early, because it was a scary thing that they were doing, and they were very short missions. So,
did you meet a lot of these new breed of astronauts? I mean, did you get to spend time with any of these guys/women?
I did, yes. I remember the first astronaut I met down at Johnson Space Center, Lee Morin. I remember I was, one of the researchers I was talking to said, oh, we'll be going over to talk to some crew later on. And I said, crew? You mean an astronaut? I said, yeah. So I went, I thought, oh, I said, can I come with you? I'd like to, meet him. And it was this, they pointed out, there's Lee over there. And it's this guy, it's kind of big lumbering guy in a Hawaiian shirt and chinos. One foot kind of turns in and glasses. And he's a little chubby. And I thought, it's like, that's him,
yeah, right?
Just couldn't be nice, and couldn't be a nicer man. I remember walking away from the conversation thinking, "Oh my God, they're just people."
It was really an interesting. Not heroes, and
no, I mean all the iconography from the Apollo era, which is where most of us left the space program. Most of us haven't really followed it that closely. The big white suit, larger than life, lumbering along, the visor, kind of faceless, almost beyond human.
And not only that, there was always sitting watching with the perfect little family, the perfect wife with the bubble hairdo, and it was just all of a piece, I think, from that time in the 60s, mm-hmm. what constituted the American ideal.
Right, right, and it was very processed and very regimented what was handed out to the media, to Life magazine, to all the television, that was very carefully controlled to portray that larger-than-life mythology. And then you have someone like me who comes in and wants to write an entire chapter about the challenges of the zero-gravity toilet.
Right.
The reality of what is it like to try to live as a human being in a place for which we're not at all adapted. There's no gravity, there's no air. I mean, it is the craziest place to try to live as a human being. And all of these bizarre and surreal situations develop and simulations that happen here on Earth. And so, this book is quite different than the typical astronaut memoir.
Let's jump right into some of that, because you were able, through simulation, to experience the zero gravity. And you write in the book about just your body in space. And I love this because it's just very direct.
Okay. You never think about the weight of your organs inside you. Your heart is a half-pound clapper hanging off the end of your aorta. Your arms burden your shoulders like buckets on a yoke. The colon uses the uterus as a beanbag chair. Even the weight of your hair imparts a sensation on your scalp. In weightlessness, all this disappears. Your organs float inside your torso. The result is a subtle physical euphoria, an indescribable sense of being freed from something you did not realize was there. And there's a footnote.
Let's hear the footnote.
Okay. The line, your organs float inside your torso. They migrate under your ribcage, reducing your waistline in a way no diet can. One NASA researcher called it the space beauty treatment. Without gravity, your hair has more body. Your breasts don't sag. More of your body fluid migrates to your head and plumps your crow's feet. Because blood volume sensors are in the upper body only, your system thinks you are retaining too much fluid and dumps 10 to 15% of your water weight. Then again, I have also heard this called puffy face chicken leg syndrome.
I love the breasts don't sag. I think that's a beautiful thing. Actually.
No, you really, people look fabulous in zero gravity. Sort of, photographers were sometimes, particularly middle-aged women, you'll have them lie down so that you're, is that kind of effect, everything's up.
Well, what also happens with weightlessness that you spend some time on is the regurgitation phenomenon. Do you want to talk about that a little bit and what happens? Because you do spend some time talking about what happens if you vomit in your helmet.
Yes, that is a not trivial question, actually. The time that you're wearing a spacesuit is when you're outside the spaceship. You are doing repairs. You are in this sort of self-contained. It's a little tiny body-shaped room, and if you get sick, and people do get sick in space because it does a number on your vestibular system, you can't just grab a vomit bag and hold it to your mouth because there's a helmet. So there was a concern, and in zero gravity, the material would just be floating, and the surface tension would kind of hold it to your face, and you could literally suffocate. So I asked a suit technician about this, and he said, "Do you not think that we didn't think about this?" He said, "There's two channels of air that are flowing down over the front of the face that would sort of wash the material down into the space, the body of the spacesuit, which is disgusting but not fatal." So, in fact, you probably wouldn't die. The biggest danger is, in fact, visor splatter. That would be that you might be unable to see because of the material, which brings me to Charlie Duke, my favorite Apollo astronaut. This guy, not throwing up, but he had a problem with his in-suit drink bag, which is sort of like a camel bag, where you have you've got the little thing inside the helmet, and you squeeze it, and you get liquid. So they had Tang in those during the Apollo missions, and Charlie Duke he had some malfunction issues with his in-suit drink bag, such that Tang, and this is a guy, he's on the moon, the acme of his career. Tang all over his hair, leaking down his face. At one point, he's like looking out at the moonscape, and there's these two craters called Wreck and Trap. He says, "Yeah," and this is all in the mission transcript. He says, "Yeah, I can see Wreck and Trap and orange juice." Can you imagine? It's like,
yeah,
there you are on the moon.
Well, so they have to, in testing these helmets, they have to simulate. I'm not dwelling on this, but they have to simulate throwing up in your helmet.
Yes.
And I found it interesting that they use...
Oh, yes, Progresso vegetable soup number 2, I think it was.
You uncovered, Mary.
Yes, yes, indeed.
The other thing, I love how you described the spacesuit as a body-shaped room.
Yes.
Because that makes me think about Jim Lovell. And Jim Lovell was described in your book as the astronaut with the problem. Tell us about his problem in this body-shaped room.
Lovell is typically known for his, the larger problem of Apollo 13. Houston.
Well, that was a problem.
Houston, we have a problem, the problem. But I didn't talk to him about Apollo 13. I called him about Gemini 7 because I was fascinated with this. Gemini was a very short-lived space program. It was basically preparing to go to the moon. So working through all of the different systems and things that were going to have to be done, they were doing sort of dress rehearsals in space. So for Gemini 7, this is the first time anybody had spent 2 weeks. It was a 2-week mission. Before then, it had been like 3, 4, 5 days, whatever. And this was, let's see, 2 weeks in a spacesuit, without showering, without changing your clothes. Can a human being stand it? Is that just too much to ask? In a small space, sort of like you and I, mm-hmm. sitting here for 2 weeks in bulky pressure suits, not inflated, but nonetheless. I asked Jim Lovell what did it smell like for for those frogmen who came and like opened the door, and he says, different, he caught himself, different from the fresh ocean breezes outside. But I read elsewhere in another conversation, actually in his oral history, he said, "Yeah, it was like living in a latrine for 2 weeks."
Now, is he the one, or was it his co-astronaut did they both unzip their suits?
Well, they were both supposed to have the suits on the whole time. NASA was the early days of space, and everything was like a disaster was around the corner, and they thought, we want the pressure suits on in case the capsule depressurizes, in case it springs a leak. We want those suits on. And so they wanted them in the suits 24/7, and these are not comfortable items. And they finally let Lovell out of the suit, and Borman had to stay in the suit. And Borman was complaining. So finally they said, "All right, Borman, you can get out now, but Lovell, you've got to get back in the suit." And there's this great moment in the mission transcript where Lovell says, "I'd rather not." They finally gave in, let them both peel off their suits. And so they were wearing just sort of the long johns. And Jim Lovell's son to this says that Jim Lovell reports that at the time his son, who was probably like 13, said, "Yeah, my dad orbited Earth in his underwear."
You're listening to author Mary Roach with musical group One Ring Zero on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. So before we had the astronauts, we had the chimps. Tell us about Albert, the rhesus monkey.
Oh, yes, the Alberts were the very first rockets in the West were the spoils of war. They were World War II. You know, we had these rockets, and we sort of imported these personnel to work with them from Germany. And there was a group of men who thought, like, we could use these not just in warfare, but as a device to put mankind up in space where he has never been before, and we could see what does that do to the human body, and can you even live in zero gravity? There was a lot of hand-wringing about the blood will not circulate, the eyeball will change shape, and the person will be blinded. The vestibular system won't work. People will just go mad as soon as they're in zero gravity, because nobody knew, will they be able to swallow? What will happen? So they first, the Alberts, it was a series of Alberts 1 through 6, who went up on Aero-B rockets and V-2 rockets, and they were wired up to, heartbeat and blood pressure, and they were anesthetized but alive, and that was the very first steps into space. And then we went to chimps, and that was a source of great contention, because the Mercury astronauts felt like, we are test pilots. We haven't been in space, but we've been close enough, and you don't need to send a chimp, and time is running out, and they've got Yuri Gagarin breathing down our next here, and so there was a fair amount of animosity between the chimp crew and even though they used all the same equipment, they went out to the gantry in the same van, they used the same testing, the centrifuge, they'd ride the same centrifuge, but the astronauts didn't have anything to do with the chimps. And
well, I read somewhere, and I think you say in here, that the reason ultimately that they replaced the chimps with men is so we'd be interested. So that there'd be some human interest element.
Right.
Because at that time, things were so controlled from the launch site that...
Right. The Mercury capsules could be done by the astronaut, or they could be done, as Michael Collins put it, in chimp mode, which was from the ground. It basically was a projectile that you threw up there, and then it came back down.
So it was a public relations.
So it was well. At that point, it was a race to have the first human in space,
right?
Versus the cosmonauts, in which Yuri Gagarin won. But it was, it was really not. You could pilot them. You could steer them from here, and there wasn't a lot of steering to be done. It's really just throw it up there, and go and get it when it comes down.
Moving on to sort of a more serious subject, the psychology of isolation and confinement. That's pretty severe. Depression can be a result.
Yeah, isolation and confinement it's the psychology of being locked in a small room with a lot of people that you didn't choose to be with. And it can be pretty insidious. Space is a very frustrating environment. You don't have a lot of control over your situation, and so this frustration builds up, and it kind of morphs to anger, and anger wants an outlet. Well, if you're in space with a bunch of people that you depend on for your survival, you don't want to take it out on them. So what happens is it's a psychological term called displacement, and in space, the guys at mission control tend to get the brunt of it. A lot of grumpiness gets, directed at mission control. And on Gemini 7, the one I was talking about with Jim Lovell, it was Frank Borman and Jim Lovell. And rather than, Lovell was saying, I didn't take it out on Frank because, I depend on this guy for my survival. So you would see when you read the mission transcript, Jim Lovell getting more and more grumpy with, in his case, it was the nutritionist. He'd get on the radio like, memo to Dr. Chance, chicken a la king, serial number 6549, cannot even get food through the tube, and then like a minute later, further memo, to Dr. Chance, Chicken a la King, all over window at this time. you could just tell he was just had to let it out. But if you don't, and the other thing that happens, if you don't let the anger out, you turn it inward, and that classically in psychological circles, they recognize that as a depression. It's just, you get depressed. And that was something I talked to some cosmonauts who'd spent, there's two of them, and they'd spent 6 months on Mir together. And I said, did you get depressed? Because I understand, you spend a lot of time, you don't want to take it out on each other. Did you turn it inward? And what he said, and his name was Alexander Levakin. He said, Mary, there were times when I was so depressed I wanted to hang myself. But it's zero gravity. And you can't.
You said something earlier when we were talking about the Chilean miners and that whole phenomenon.
This wasn't that long after Packing for Mars came out, and I got a bunch of phone calls from the media wanting to know, what will help them? What can we do for them? What does science know? Because NASA, NASA has done a lot of work with trying to mitigate the effects of isolation and confinement and the depression that happens. But it really wasn't a similar scenario, because it's in space, you've got the fact that, you're in space, which was your whole life's goal. There's a positive side. The Chilean miners didn't really have a positive side. On the other hand, they had more space. There was 2 miles of tunnels. They had good leadership. That's the other thing. Some kind of a chain of command and a strong sense of hierarchy. So the Chilean miners were tricky. The fact that they themselves took action. They organized themselves, and they had a lot of communication with the family, which is a huge source of morale for astronauts as well.
Right.
There's radio communication and email.
What you mentioned food. So let's talk for a moment about Wally Schirra and the corned beef sandwich. It's a great story.
Yeah, the corned beef. This was Gemini 3, I believe it was, it was from Wolfie's Delicatessen in Cocoa Beach, Florida, and it was smuggled on board just as kind of a joke. But it was when this went public, because it's all everything's on record, and when the media found out about the corned beef sandwich, it went all the way to a congressional subcommittee hearing, budgetary NASA hearing. It was just the guy who was, I forget the name of the head of NASA, but people were saying, if you can't control your astronauts, how can you control the space agency? And the other thing is that they felt that it made a mockery of the science, because what they were looking at then, they were very concerned with calories in and calories out. They were monitoring metabolism in space, so they had very specially prepared and very unappetizing, dried out small little foods that they were supposed to eat, and the fact that they brought the sandwich up was going to throw all of that if they'd eaten it, which they didn't. But
it's sort of dematerialized, or
oh well, the, yes. And the other thing about a corned beef sandwich, a large corned beef sandwich in a zero gravity environment, it's breaking apart. There's things floating everywhere, and when you
mustard,
have a lot of
mayonnaise.
Crumbs, yeah, exactly. You've got crumbs everywhere, and they're not falling to the ground where the janitor will come and deal with them. They're floating, they can get in your eye, they can get behind the instrument panel. So it was just, the nutritionists were just like, oh my God. Because the foods, if you look at the foods, the early space foods were just, they were trying to make them lightweight, calorie dense, and also concerned with, because there was no toilet, there was no bathroom on the early Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, just bags to use. You didn't want to be using the bag very often, so the food was designed to be low residue.
So were these the sandwich cubes?
Yes, sandwich cubes, bacon bites, beef bites, little tiny, and they coated them with these sort of oily coatings to prevent crumbs, and the astronauts would, they tended to fly all the way up into space and all the way back down, because they weren't eating them, they were...
Well, what about the tubes? I mean, it would seem that all of the wonderful things about eating... smell,
yes,
and
that
texture.
Was the complaint.
And that's absent.
Yeah. The complaint with the tubes was, I can't see or smell what I'm about to eat. And this is what the astronauts would say. And the nutritionists would come back and say, you can't see or smell when you open a can of Coors. It's like a beer can is not that different. But that was the complaint, that, you know, you're taking this tube and you're just on good faith squeezing it into your mouth. And I've tried some of those tubed foods. And? I tried one called Sloppy Joe. And the thing is, it has to come out a hole about that big. So, you know, if I eat Sloppy Joe, I want some Joe in it. You know,
you need paper towels. You need...
Well, you want some... It was just sauce. It's basically sauce. You're just sort of squirting sauce in your mouth, and it's... That's a depressing thing to not have something to chew.
Has it improved, or is that the new space food was the Sloppy Joe tube?
No, it hasn't. These days, they've got a lot more room, and they can... It's sort of the size of a briefcase, and you stick these sort of... It looks like a boil in a bag, and you stick it in and heat it up, and... You can use a spoon. For years, they thought, oh, you can't use a spoon, it'll float off. And then somebody thought, well, let's try it. And if you make it a little more viscous, it will stick to the spoon. You just have to, you know. Astronauts, they're like toddlers. They have to relearn how to eat, how to go to the bathroom, how to cross a room. I mean, you take these, you know, top of their class, high-ranking, high-achieving, summa cum laude, top of West Point, whatever, and you put them back in nursery school. It's a very odd process.
Well, speaking of eating and drinking... They can reconstitute their sweat and their urine as a nutrition source, or correct
water.
Me,
yes,
yeah, as
yeah,
water.
Yeah.
And did you do that?
Well, I I don't know why you would think I would do that. No, I did it. For that chapter, I thought it would be down at NASA Ames, which is just down the peninsula. The scientist who came up with the urine recycling rig that is on the International Space Station. He's down there, and I thought, well, I'll go and have lunch in the Ames cafeteria, and I thought to make it a little more interesting that we would both treat our glass of urine, and that would be our beverage. And it's actually not, it's all in your head, honestly. It's not that bad.
People in the desert who have no water and are dying, I mean, drinking your own urine
well,
is not
yeah,
unheard
and in
of.
This case, it had been filtered with activated charcoal, which removed all the objectionable smells and tastes and things. And then the salts were taken out. The salt and sugar molecules sort of swapped place. So it was very, very sweet. So
Apparently, your husband did not like having it in your refrigerator. True?
No. I remember, because I said to the guy at NASA Ames, well, I'll do this the night before, and then I'll meet you for lunch. And he said, okay, well, be sure to put it in the refrigerator. So I put it in the refrigerator, and Ed's going, well, what is that? And I told him, and he said, can't you put it out on the deck? Isn't it cold enough? Put it on. He said, I am really disgusted to have that in the refrigerator. And I tried to say, well, the astronauts do it. You know, in an emergency situation, Ed said it would have to be apocalyptic for me to drink.
One of your chapters is titled, Can Space Blow Your Mind? And you describe space euphoria. What is that? What is space euphoria?
Oh, space euphoria was... space euphoria happened with the first two astronauts to float freely in space. Alexei Leonov, the cosmonaut, and Ed White, the American astronaut. And then, and there was this fear. There was a lot of concern that when a human being went out into the vast infinite reaches of space, you know, just tethered to the capsule with this umbilical, that, you know, his mind would be blown. But what happened instead, in both cases, the astronaut and the cosmonaut, they were just overcome with this euphoria and just this sense. Ed White, if you read the mission transcript, he didn't want to get back in. He kept saying, because he was out there taking pictures, and mission control would be going to his McDivitt, who was his crew member, like, get him back in. And he'd be going, Ed, you got to get, they want you back in. He goes, I've got another shot, a better shot of the capsule. No, Ed, you've got to come back in. Just one more minute. Oh, hold on. You know, and just finally, like way beyond the amount of time he was supposed to be out there, he finally goes, coming in now, this is the saddest moment of my life. And then they were talking. And these are two Air Force guys. You know, there's like McDivitt's going, wow, you look like you were back in your mother's womb. Ed White's going, yeah, it was just so natural. It was just kind of amazing. Those mission transcripts, you know, 90% of it is jargon back and forth, but there would be these moments of extreme humanity and quite sort of awesome
And emotions. I imagine getting out of the capsule must have been just so liberating, getting out of that enclosed space.
Yeah, I would have thought terrifying, but they seemed to not be terrified. They seemed to be, and both of them had a great deal of difficulty getting back in. I mean, it was a life and death situation. In both cases, they weren't able to come in the way they'd trained, and they kind of got stuck, and it was, in both cases, pretty scary.
I mentioned that you had got to experience, witness a lot of simulations because that's how they prepare people to go in space,
right,
and how they do the research and so forth. And one of them is with crash simulation, like what happens,
yeah,
when there's a crash. Most of us, I think, assume that they use test crash dummies. But...
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's similar in automotive testing. There are sort of standardized tests that are done with crash test dummies. But when you're calibrating a dummy, you need to actually use a human cadaver. A human cadaver. This was actually, now we're going to Stiff, my first book. But a crash test dummy will tell you how much force, say, that hits, say, the steering wheel hitting the chest. But if you don't know what that amount of force would do to a human body, the data is meaningless. So they have to do, they did all this work in the 60s on impact tolerance, which was, you know, how much force does it take to, you know, to break the sternum or to cause the aorta to shear or, you know, the skull to crack or et cetera, because they need that. Then the data from the dummies, the crash test dummies, would be meaningful. You'd know, is that a fatal crash or is that an injury that the person will recover from?
Did you see these tests being done on human cadavers?
I did. I saw.
And are these fresh cadavers? I mean, recently...
Fresh frozen.
Just, the picture in my mind is too bizarre for words.
It's not, you know, it's, well, it is a little bizarre because they had them dressed in, this guy was in a ankle to neck Danskin powder blue leotard. And I asked the guy who had dressed him, I said, where do you get these leotards? And he said, from the dance supply company. They would be disgusted if they knew. But they do that so that they want something tight fitting. So, because when they film it in extra, you know, high speed video, so that way they can see the whole, you know, what's happening when they play it back in slow motion. So they want to be able to see all the musculature and exactly what's going on. So I don't know why powder blue, but so it's a guy in a powder blue leotard sitting in a car seat in a lab, and then there's an impactor, and that's just a piston comes out, you know, just goes like boom.
Hard,
yeah. And the cadaver kind of like slumps over. And it's all very anticlimactic. I mean, when you take away the screeching tires and the crash and everything, it's just the force in one spot, it's just kind of surreal but not particularly disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, he had kind of a personality in a way because, you know, they'd sit in the chair and you had to be in driving position. If you're dead, it's hard to stay in driving position. So he kind of like slump. You know, and then they'd put him back up, and then they didn't...
Right? They called him Fred?
UM006 was this guy.
Oh.
Yeah, I think there was a Fred elsewhere in the book. But, so, you know, he had this sort of comics timing, because they'd get him all ready, and they'd have the video set up. Okay, we ready? And they'd be all ready to go, and then, like, UM006 would be like... so, you know, he kind of had a personality. But anyway, NASA was doing a cadaver, testing a capsule that we were going to go back to the moon, and now that's been scrapped. But the capsule that would take the astronauts back and forth comes down on the ocean, splashdown, kind of hearkening back to the Apollo days, splashdown, and the ocean is unpredictable, and so if the capsule comes down, it hits, you know, by a wave sideways. There's a lot of different variables. They were trying to make sure, with all these different directions and forces, will the crew be safe, or will the spacesuit, you know, those hard parts of the spacesuit, will it, like in this case they were testing, would it smash into the arm and break the arm? And there's not really a crash test dummy set up for that particular scenario, so they were doing tests with a number of cadavers. These were people who had donated themselves to science, having no idea they'd become astronauts.
Women as well, or all men that you saw?
I saw a man, but I would imagine that they were doing some women as well because there's female crew members.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author Mary Roach with musical group One Ring Zero. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. One of the places they did or simulations to give them information was Devon Island.
Yes.
Tell us about Devon Island.
Devon Island is way, way up in the Canadian Arctic. It's like 200 miles from the magnetic North Pole. It is a large uninhabited island that you drive around there on an ATV, a little, you know, little vehicle, and you really can make yourself feel that you are on the moon. It looks, it's very barren. Parts of it are very, very gray. Parts of it are red, and they do Mars simulations there as well. And so NASA uses the terrain to test prototype rovers, to do suit testing, just anything that. When I was up there, they were testing. They were going to be doing double rover expeditions. You know, back in the Apollo days, you'd go out in your golf cart, basically, you know, for a couple of hours and come back. You wouldn't stray too far from the home base. But if they were going to build a moon base, and people have been going out for 2 weeks. It would have been like an RV trip on the moon, basically. These were large, pressurized vehicles with cup holders. I love that. and the guys could tool around in their shirt sleeves. It was pressurized, unlike the moon buggies. And so they were trying to figure out, up on Devon Island, we had some prototype vehicles, like, how do you do that? How far apart do you go? When do you rendezvous? What happens if one breaks down? They were kind of working through that very early preliminary. You have no idea the planning that goes into a moon mission. Even just planting the flag on the moon was, I mean, months of planning. It was, you know, everything from, okay, you want this patriotic waving in the wind. Well, there's no atmosphere on the moon. There's no wind. So they had to put the telescoping crossbar. So it's more actually a patriotic curtain. It's not actually a flag. And then where do you put it in the capsule? It's a very cramped space. A flagpole is a big thing, so it had to be. They thought, okay, we'll strap it on the ladder. You know, the ladder where Neil Armstrong came down and, you know, his historic moment. It was right there, strapped on the side. And then somebody realized, oh, you know, the descent engine, that will melt the thing. So then they had to build a protective sheath. But then will they be able to pull it out of the sheath? Because it's very hard to move your fingers in those pressurized gloves. And it was, so they did simulations. It was months. Mm. That one, you know, what you would think simple, you know, plant a flag, months and months. And then they didn't know the moon dust. Who knew? 6 inches, you know, 3 feet. What's under there? Is it rock? They got the flag down about 6 inches, Neil Armstrong says. And he speculates that when the ascent module took off, that the blast knocked the thing over. So it's probably just lying in the dust now.
Somehow the recreational vehicle doesn't give you quite the same photo op as the little golf cart with the astronauts.
No, not at all. Not at all, no.
So the question, we've talked about many things happening in space, and you do devote some time in your book to speculating about sex in space. Because
I do,
nobody
yes.
has actually admitted.
Right.
To date, that this has taken place. And was it your right. agent who really wanted this to be part of your book or this to have happened? Because, I mean, it's just so
oh,
salacious.
Oh, yeah, well, it was my agent. Yeah, I said, because my agent was saying, come on, Mary, somebody's done it. And I said, okay, Jay, imagine you're an astronaut. I mean, you trained your entire life, you know, your career, and this is like, you're up in space, you finally got there, and you want to do this again. You don't want to just go once, and you would not go back. If you had sex in space, word would get around, and that would be it. You'd never fly again. And Jay goes, I don't know, might be worth it. there was a couple that secretly got married before a shuttle mission, and there's a lot of speculation. You know, they don't say that, they just don't comment. I mean, if newlyweds, I don't know, the airlock, you would think so. But and I did get some astronauts. I asked a couple of them, like, to speculate, like, because I think actually gravity, when it comes to sexual intercourse, gravity is your friend. You want something to kind of push against. And I asked, I think it was Roger Crouch or Mike Mullane, I forget. But one of them said, oh, come on. Use your imagination. There's so many possibilities that there wouldn't be otherwise. And if all else fails, a roll of duct tape. So I asked Alexander Levakin, the guy who had said, you know, what he got, the guy talked about depression. He was quite keen to talk about sex in space. And he said, he claims that, yeah, there was one couple that, Valerie Polyakov and Elena Kondakova, who had a lot of flirtation, but she's married to someone else in the astronaut corps. And he said, believe me, we hounded him. Did you guys do it? Did you guys do it? He said, stop asking me this question. So I don't know. But I said, well, so you're up there for 6 months. It's two guys. I mean, what do you do? I mean, this is obviously a frustrating thing. And he said, I know. My friends are asking me all the time, how are you making sex in space? And he says, of course, by hand. I love the cosmonauts. They're very, you know, he said, it's natural. It happens in your sleep. There's always opportunities. It's not a big deal. Everybody does it. And I thought, thank you. Why can't NASA? I mean, people, you call NASA and they're like, we're not discussing that. Not important. We are doing very important things in space. We don't need to discuss that. It's insulting to the intelligence of the astronauts. Like, no, it's not.
So the sense of humor at NASA hasn't gotten any better?
It depends on which NASA. NASA Johnson Space Center is very straight. There's some sense of humor down at Ames. The guy, the urine guy, he said, yeah, he was actually making a joke. But he said, yes, we are NASA. We have no sense of humor that we know of. But he had a good sense of humor.
Well, I think what we're going to do now is bring out One Ring Zero. Then we're going to take questions from Mary Roach and then proceed to the book signing. So let's hear again from Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp and One Ring Zero.
So we have a special treat. We, you know, simply just wasn't enough theremin happening tonight. So I've somehow managed to convince Mary to play theremin with us on this next song. Ladies and gentlemen, Mary Roach on theremin. I gave her a crash course.
Not only have I never played theremin, I've never played any musical instrument. Talk about I suck. Okay.
This is to prove that the theremin is magic or something like that.
Yeah.
All about houseplants.
All the plants are on fire. All the plants are on fire. They have a secret life. They have a secret life. All the plants are on fire. They're looking for a wife.
Mary Roach. Roach.
All
Roach.
The pots have turned to gold.
Keep going.
All the leaves are almost old. All the plants are on fire. In my house in the rain.
All the plants are on fire.
All the plants are on fire. They have a secret life. They have a secret life. All the plants are on fire. They're looking for a wife.
You're doing good. Eat more notes.
All their pots have turned to gold. All their leaves are almost old. All the plants are on fire. In my house in the rain.
John Thurman.
Thank you. So I know it's going to be hard to recover from this excitement, but if you can draw your attention back to Packing for Mars, it's now your turn to ask questions of Mary Roach. So, yeah, take it away.
Hello, thank you. So as Voyager is leaving the solar system, how likely do you think that humans will be able to leave the solar system?
Well, I have faith that at some point the space program will get back on track. Right now, everything is completely rudderless, and we don't have a game plan, so that's a little dispiriting. But I have faith that we will push onward, and because, like we were talking about before, it's without the human factor, people tend to lose interest. And when people lose interest, you lose funding. You know, no, they always say, no bucks without Buck Rogers. So I can't be very specific, but I think it will continue. It would be sad to get, you know, all this way. I mean, the International Space Station era, really, that was all about what they were doing up there was learning how to live in space long term. It was a lot of science that had to do with getting ready to go to Mars. So for it to end now seems sort of anticlimactic.
Hi, Mary. I believe you spent some time in Japan looking at their space program.
Yeah.
And I heard you tell a story about the bento boxes. Could you? I didn't get to hear the whole thing, so I wasn't sure. Could you tell us more about that?
Bento boxes.
Well, a luncheon thing. How the lunches had to be repacked.
Okay. Yes, this was okay. I was there when they were choosing two astronauts for the Japanese Astronaut Corps, and they had some unusual ways of testing them. They put them in an isolation chamber, a sort of a simulated ship, for a week. And I was imagining kind of emergencies where they'd set something on fire and see how they, you know, dealt with it. But they did things like they had them do 100 origami cranes and then looked at how did the first one compare to the last one as a test of accuracy under pressure. Can you imagine, like, John Glenn folding origami cranes? And the lunch, this was, they ate lunch, and then their plates were secretly, it was like one of those, we've secretly replaced this coffee with Sanka. It's like they secretly taken away, and somebody photographed their empty dishes to see how they'd put them back and what they had eaten or not eaten. And then the photographs were sent to a psychologist who would then take a look at those. And I mean, I don't know how that interpretation influenced to the two that they chose. But anyway, that was the
fascinating.
Interesting.
I want to see if I can sneak in two questions. But one is, what does your husband think of all this? Like, is he a big eye roll about it, or is he really on board with you? And the other, do you have amazing dreams or nightmares because of...
Okay. Well, the first one, my husband is unbelievably supportive. I mean, if anybody's read Bonk, I don't know if anybody here... Bonk was, Ed and I were the subjects of a four-dimensional ultrasound video of genitals having sex. I mean, ultrasound, the guy's right there with the wand. So it was in London, so at least he got the free trip to London. Ed is actually here. If he stand up and take a bow. Where is he? Ah, there he is. Yay!
That doesn't look like Ed. Just kidding.
incredibly, you could not find a more supportive husband, really. So fabulous. And except for the urine in the refrigerator, really very tolerant about all of it. And my dreams, what's interesting? I have dreams where I'm flying, and sometimes I'm flying indoors where I'd be like pushing off, it would be a room like this very high, and I'd push off the walls and then go to the other wall and push off. And zero gravity was exactly like that. It was like I was experiencing my dream. It was really quite extraordinary. But anyway, I don't remember my dreams that often. No nightmares.
Hi, I guess wondering, given some of the previous topics of your books, if you had any anxiety on the part of press offices or other people that you're talking to for this one about exactly what topics might be covered or...
While I was doing the book, you mean, or now? You mean while
whether
I was...
Whether they wanted to run when they saw you coming.
Yeah, when you were doing your research, like, what's she going to say?
Yes,
like,
no, there was a certain element of discomfort, yes, it's funny because they were, on some levels, incredibly welcoming. Like for the zero gravity toilet chapter, they're like, "Come on down. You can go into the shuttle potty training room. You can use the positional trainer, which is a toilet with a video camera with a display right there of your ass." You know, they were like, "Go ahead, try it out." So there were some things where I thought they'd be like, "You want to talk about what?" But some things they were very comfortable with, and other things they were like the cadaver chapter. They were very, very, kept saying no so many times. Finally, the researcher, who's not NASA, just said, "Mary, just show up and we'll deal with it." So that was quite a morning.
So you needed to be persistent.
Persistent, yes. And working, you sort of, yeah, you kind of trying to find out, well, what is your concern? And maybe we can address that. We can do it anonymously, or you can read the quotes, or tell me why you're saying no. But with NASA, it's frequently we're saying no because we think we might lose our job. The public affairs people. So, yeah, it was more trying. This book was a little more challenging in that way than some of the others. But then again, Stiff and the sex labs, yeah, like, yeah, come on in and take notes while people are, yeah, that was tough too.
Intrepid would be the word, I think.
And we have a young gentleman here.
Don't astronauts grow in space because they're getting stretched out in no gravity?
Yes, very good. That's right. In zero gravity, the curvature of your spine flattens out, and there's a couple other things that go on. So you end up a couple of inches, it depends on how tall you already are, but yeah, a couple inches taller in zero gravity. You are also, when you wake up in the morning, I believe, you are taller than when you went to bed. Yeah.
What a great question.
But great question, yes.
Where did you simulate no gravity, and can I have directions?
Oh, yeah. I was on, it's called a parabolic flight, and it's a jet that goes like this, okay? You go out, you know, out over the ocean. It's not in space, it's just going like this, and as it goes over the top and down, you have about 20, 25 seconds of weightlessness, and then as it goes, pulls out of the dive, you actually are double, 1.5 to 2 times what you would normally weigh. So you lie down on the bottom of the plane, and like you can't pick your head up because your muscles aren't strong enough. So you go from being really heavy to, then you sort of rise up. It's like the rapture in there. All these people like sort of rising up off the bottom of the plane and floating around. It's just fabulous, and they give you good drugs. So so you don't get sick. Most people, there were a couple unfortunate people. You really don't want to get sick because, apparently it's harder to throw up. The stuff weighs twice as much? I don't know. But you can pay, I think it's between $4,000 and $5,000 to go on a zero-gravity flight. I know. But if you're a journalist, do you happen to be a journalist? If you were a journalist, you can cover, it's the NASA Student Flights Opportunities, and it's engineering and aerospace students who've competed to go on a flight and do some zero-gravity research work. So, and each team can bring a journalist. So that's your angle there.
So once again, Mary Roach will be signing books in the atrium. Thanks to all of you for coming. Thanks to One Ring Zero, and thanks to Mary Roach. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author Mary Roach with musical group One Ring Zero, led by Michael Hurst and Joshua Camp. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Michael Geese Graphics, Brandon Battaglia, Devin Krushank, and David Kwan. David Kwan also edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon for McSweeney's Fall Harvest, featuring authors Adam Levin, Peter Orner, and Darren Strauss. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.